This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 21st of September, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Chile's Supreme Court rules Peru's former president, Alberto Fujimori, be extradited to face human rights abuses and corruption charges. Democratic senators call for increased transparency as tensions heighten in Baghdad over last week's deadly shooting involving Blackwater. And Republican candidates court the NRA vote, while some Democratic candidates are barred from a forum on health care. Those stories and more after the headlines.
These are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Mitch Jezrich at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Thousands of Lebanese attended the funeral of a slain Christian parliamentarian who was assassinated earlier in the week. It is the third assassination of a pro-government MP in the last year. Jackson Allers has more from Beirut.
The brass band played as the body of seven Lebanese were laid to rest this morning, victims of Wednesday's car bomb. They included assassinated Christian MP Antoine Ghanem, a fierce critic of Syrian influence in Lebanon. Ghanem had been in exile for 3 months following the assassination of another pro-government MP in June. He returned to Lebanon 3 days prior to his own assassination. Ghanem's death reduced the government's support in parliament, which could play into the favor of the Hezbollah-led opposition. Currently, the pro-government side has 68 of 127 seats. The loss of two more seats would take away the current government's simple majority in parliament. A consensus candidate for the presidency must be reached to avoid the naming of two rival governments, one backed by the United States and European powers and the other supported by Syria and Iran. Analysts say that such a power vacuum is reminiscent of the 1975 to 1990 Lebanese Civil War. Meanwhile, the United States and Lebanese government supporters are blaming Syria for the bomb, while the opposition has blamed Sunni Islamist elements rooted in Lebanon. Reporting from East Beirut, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
Senate Democrats failed to muster the necessary 60 votes today to break a filibuster on their proposal to have U.S. troops withdrawn from Iraq within the next 9 months. In fact, they received fewer votes for this measure, 47, than they did for the same proposal in July. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina led the opposition.
It is a de facto return to the old strategy. For 3.5 years, we had a strategy on the ground in Iraq that did not produce results that were beneficial.
Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid says Congress's inability to force troops out of Iraq is leading to more destruction.
Today, thousands of Iraqis will abandon their homes and neighborhoods to flee as refugees to Iran, Jordan, Syria, and other countries. Those Iraqis who remain will face what has become the daily norm of life in Iraq: water shortages, no electricity, the constant threat of violence. And today we learned cholera, an ancient disease that has now hit the ancient land of Iraq. Remember, Mr. President, 1.2 million Iraqis have been killed since our military invasion.
Democrats say they may introduce a measure next week that would include a timeline as a goal rather than a binding date, hoping to attract more lawmakers. The French government, under a new conservative leadership, continues its tough talk with Iran. Today, the country's foreign minister, Bernard Kouchner, after meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, said France would support additional sanctions.
We may hope that there will be a third resolution to reinforce the sanctions, which up until now have not been very effective.
Kouchner spoke during a joint press conference with Secretary Rice in Washington. Rice, for her part, said that the U.S. is still seeking a diplomatic solution to halt Iran's development of nuclear technology. Iran says such technology is being developed for peaceful purposes. Thousands took to the streets in Burma today for the fourth day of protest against the military-ruled government. Ronald Ong Young reports.
Today, in military-ruled Burma, thousands of people led by Buddhist monks took to the street again in the country's capital of Rangoon, marking the fourth day of protest against the government. Thousands of monks and people in at least six other towns also demonstrated to show solidarity and protest against the military-led government. The monks' religious boycott was launched on Tuesday after authorities refused to apologize for a violent crackdown on some of the monks who previously demonstrated against the sudden price hike on gasoline and natural gas. While Buddhist monks and people in Burma sustained their rare protests, the United Nations Security Council held closed-door meeting to discuss the situation in Burma. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ronald Online in Chiang Mai.
Bail has been denied for Michael Bell, the first youth convicted in the so-called Gina 6 trial in Louisiana. Alice Woodward is a reporter with Revolution Newspaper. She was on the scene when Michael Bell's father announced the decision.
When people found out about this, there was a visible show of outrage and support for Michael Bell. People were chanting, "No justice, no peace." They were following Melissa Bell, who's Michael Bell's mother, out of the courthouse. She emerged tearful, of course, because her son is still being held. And the people were saying, "We're with you 100%. We're not going to stop. We're going to come back until they're released." They were chanting, and that was the response right there on the lawn of the courthouse.
And that was Alice Woodward of the Revolution Newspaper. Meanwhile, police in Louisiana say they've arrested an 18-year-old accused of driving with two hangman's nooses dangling from his pickup truck. The arrest came after the teen allegedly drove past a crowd of people who had attended a civil rights march earlier in the day. Thousands of demonstrators protested yesterday in Louisiana in the wake of a 2006 incident that began with nooses being hung from a tree. Hundreds of people gathered in Chicago yesterday to attend a Federal Communications Commission hearing on its media ownership rules. Matthew Lazar reports.
This is the fifth of six scheduled hearings on the FCC's media ownership rules, guidelines that govern how many radio stations, TV stations, and newspapers a single entity can own. Representatives of Chicago's black community featured prominently at the event. Speaker after speaker said that media consolidation had robbed Chicagoans of access to local radio and television. Karen Bond of the National Black Coalition for Media Justice said that Chicago represented a stark example of the impact of the FCC's lax radio ownership rules.
In Chicago, one company almost entirely dominates the black community's radio music industry, the advertising rate, and most importantly, our main source of news and information about the black community.
The FCC is committed to one more public hearing on its media ownership regulations. Then the five-member commission must vote on new rules. Matthew Lazar, Free Speech Radio News.
A state government in Nigeria has fired all 34,000 of its service employees following a protracted strike. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The Oyo State government in southwestern Nigeria sacked the 34,000 workers following a strike over salary increase. The strike has been on in the last 3 weeks. The workers went on strike to demand for a 50% pay rise. But the state government says it does not recognize the strike, adding that the workers have to be let go for staying away from work without permission. The state parliament has expressed support for the government's action, but human rights groups and labor organizations have expressed outrage. Nigeria's main workers' union says a massacre of the workers cannot stop their agitation for a just wage. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
And I'm Mitch Jezerich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
Democratic senators called for increased transparency in legal investigations of security contractor actions in Iraq today as tensions heighten in Baghdad after last week's deadly shooting involving Blackwater employees. The incident took the lives of at least 9 Iraqis on Sunday and prompted the Iraqi parliament to ban all operations of the prominent defense contractor Blackwater, which holds contracts for U.S. diplomatic envoys in Iraq. Catherine Jarmel reports.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada addressed the Democratic policy hearing and questioned the oversight of security contractors within the context of U.S. policy.
Who are these contractors accountable to? What laws apply to them? This is certainly seen in Iraq. They don't know whether the Iraqi law applies, American law applies. Obviously, no law applies.
Jeremy Scahill, an investigative reporter and panel witness, says private contractors evade prosecution.
Despite many reports, some from U.S. military commanders, of private contractors firing indiscriminately at Iraqis and vehicles and killing civilians, not a single armed contractor has been charged with any crime.
One concern of contractors' expanding role in Iraq is that it could affect the safety of U.S. troops on the ground. Nick Buchanick, documentary filmmaker and panel witness.
The Iraqis do not differentiate between armed security contractors and U.S. soldiers. In other words, security contractors are America's public diplomats, and yet these same contractors are not held to the same oversight or standards of accountability as the soldiers are.
Buchanick says the numbers of contractors currently in Iraq ranges from 20,000 to 150,000, depending on who you ask. Senator Jim Webb of Virginia emphasized that the proliferation of private contractors in Iraq was not the intent of congressmen and women.
We have slid into this, ineluctably slid into this, because the money was available. People didn't want to argue about the size of the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Air Force. So we allowed this quasi-military force to grow up.
The existence of this quasi-military has led to concerns over accountability. Stephen Cohn, witness and attorney for the National Whistleblower Center, describes how contractors can use loopholes to avoid prosecution in Iraq and the United States. These contractors continue operations in Iraq despite government attempts to investigate or supervise their operations.
All of a sudden, Blackwater is a State Department contractor. All of a sudden, someone else is working for the Provisional Authority. All of a sudden, there are 67 different companies showing up. It's those technical loopholes that have turned into the sinkholes.
Cohn went on to describe how these companies evade supervision by using name changes and subcontracts. An amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill would require congressional investigations into deaths and property destruction associated with security contractors in Iraq. The amendment, authored by Senators Webb and Claire McCaskill of Missouri, passed this Thursday. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel.
More than 4,000 U.S. war veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan have been diagnosed with traumatic brain injury, most often caused from gunshots or blasts from roadside bombs. Because of its frequency, many are calling physical brain damage the signature injury of the Iraq War. Most observers believe the real number of soldiers suffering from traumatic brain injury is much higher. A recent Army study found that 18% of troops who have been in Iraq likely suffered at least some brain damage from improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. FSRN's Aaron Glantz has more from Washington.
On March 19, 2004, Corporal Justin Bunce was on patrol in the city of Useiba on the Syrian border when a bomb exploded in the wall of a cemetery. The blast sent shrapnel into every part of his body and knocked Bunce into a coma for 4 days. When he was airlifted to Landstuhl Military Hospital in Germany, doctors found some of the shrapnel had lodged itself in the left frontal lobe of his brain.
Because of my brain injury, making new memories is hard as hell. I delete myself a dozen voicemails every day. By the end of the day, it looks like I have tattoos all over my arms. Well, my left arm. Left side is paralyzed, so I put it to the only use I really can and write on it.
Justin Bunce's father is retired Air Force Colonel Peter Bunce, a politically connected lobbyist who now works as president and CEO of the General Aviation Manufacturers Association. As a result, he's been able to navigate the myriad of Pentagon and Veterans Affairs bureaucracies necessary to get his son top-notch care at places like Walter Reed Medical Center and the Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center in Charlottesville, Virginia. But even with all that care, parts of Justin's body are still paralyzed. Peter Bunt says his son's life will never be the same.
He still has shrapnel in his brain in the left frontal lobe from Iraq and lost his right eye there. The other shrapnel wounds throughout the rest of his body have healed. But when you have a left frontal lobe injury, part of the governor that keeps you and I from saying things that we might be thinking but not vocalizing kind of goes away. And especially when you take a 25-year-old young man, especially when there's young ladies around, the things that he says are unpredictable and definitely a lot of times not appropriate.
Corporal Bunce has one of the more severe cases of traumatic brain injury, about 4,000 cases of which have been diagnosed among military personnel since September 11, 2001. But internal studies by the U.S. Army show as many as 300,000 U.S. soldiers and veterans have suffered at least some brain damage. People like Sergeant Patrick Campbell.
I was exposed to my first, what I like to call, possible traumatic brain injury when I dropped a tank catch on my head. It's a 75-pound tank catch. I pretty much knocked myself out. And because I was the medic, I told everyone, I'm good, let's go. But I know for a fact that I wasn't. While I was in Iraq, I experienced multiple motor vehicle accidents. We flipped a tank, we flipped a Humvee. I think we were in at least five or six. While I was there, I had a mortar rocket land about 15 feet from me. That's a rocket you fire from a couple miles away. Thankfully, I was standing on the other side of a wall, but I know the concussion, just the wave of air, almost knocked me over.
Like most servicemen who served in Iraq, Campbell has not received treatment for traumatic brain injury, and on the surface, he doesn't seem to need it. A former student body president at the University of California, Berkeley, Campbell is now enrolled in law school at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. But he says he sees a change since his service in the war.
I have a real trouble remembering things. Specifically, if I'm going someplace, I have to write it down. Thankfully, I keep a notepad. I don't have to write on my arm, but I do write things on my hand all the time. And because if I don't write it down, I'll have to look at it three or four times. I actually took one of those online screenings, and it said I have severe short-term memory loss. It helped me understand what was going on in my life, and I think that for a lot of these guys coming home who are trying to deal with who they've become, that understanding what happened to them will begin that process.
Legislation proposed by Senator Barack Obama would mandate the Pentagon screen all soldiers for traumatic brain injury when they return home from war. Senator Hillary Clinton has a bill that would appoint a Pentagon medical advocate for all patients with brain injuries to help them navigate the system surrounding their treatment. It's unclear, however, when or if Congress will vote on either of those bills. Veterans groups doubt either of them will be passed into law this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Washington, D.C.
Chile's Supreme Court ruled on appeal that Peru's former president, Alberto Fujimori, be extradited to Peru on two charges of human rights abuses and five corruption charges. The decision is a reversal to an earlier ruling made by a Supreme Court magistrate who ruled there were no grounds to extradite Fujimori. FSRN's Jorge Garretón is in Santiago with the story.
The Chilean government ordered the return of Peru's former president, Alberto Fujimori, within hours of the Chilean Supreme Court's ruling on his extradition to face charges of human rights abuse and corruption. This morning, Supreme Court Justice Alberto Chenio made the announcement to extradite Fujimori to a waiting media throng outside the court's chambers.
Se ha concedido la extradición por...
The court has ruled in favor of the extradition in seven of the 13 charges in the human rights cases of La Cantuta and Barrios Altos. The court has ruled in favor of extradition on those two cases.
Justice Chenio dismissed allegations of undue pressure coming from the Chilean government. He added the case was long and tiring. Alberto Fujimori, who ruled Peru from 1990 to 2000, will face two charges of human rights violations. One case is the Barrios Altos massacre in downtown Lima, where a death squad group known as the Colina Group, under the orders of Fujimori's right-hand man, the head of national security, Vladimiro Montesinos, in the hunt for Shining Path guerrillas, crashed the night of November 3, 1991, a party organized by area residents, killing 15, including an 8-year-old boy. The other took place July 18, 1992, at La Cantuta campus of Lima's National University. There, the Colina Group death squad gunned down a university professor and 9 students inside their classroom. Among the 5 corruption charges Fujimori will face upon his return to Peru are paying bribery to opposition politicians to switch alliances to Fujimori's party in Congress, and also charges of embezzling some $15 million. The ruling was well received by human rights groups. In Lima, Francisco Severon, the director of the Institute of Family Members Victims of Human Rights Violations, says the Supreme Court decision sets the right precedent.
The ruling is an important decision that rectifies the hideous first ruling given by Justice Alvarez. This decision validates the legal opinion of Supreme Court Prosecutor Monica Maldonado, who called for Fujimori's extradition in the first extradition case. This ruling goes a long way in correcting the court's legal standing that was put in doubt by Justice Alvarez and affirms Chile's commitment to respecting human rights and justice.
The Chile chapter of Amnesty International is also pleased with the decision, calling it historic. According to Sergio Laurenti, the Chile chapter head, the decision sets a precedent.
For Amnesty International, we salute this decision from the Supreme Court in terms of extraditing former President Alberto Fujimori to Peru. We are hoping that he be charged of human rights violations and corruption, and the Chilean Supreme Court today is very significant in terms of searching for justice for thousands of victims of torture, killings, and forced disappearances and other human rights violations committed throughout the Fujimori government era.
Fujimori told Japanese press and a Lima-based radio station that this ruling is his chance to clear his name. He said his stay in Chile was an effort to reduce the charges he faces from the Peruvian judiciary. He added his return to Peru is his chance to meet with his people. Now Fujimori has to await the steps to be taken either by the Chilean government that can fly him back to Peru or wait for a military airplane that was reported to have left Peru this morning to collect the former president. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
This week on the campaign trail, Republican candidates court the National Rifle Association, and two Democratic candidates are blocked from attending the AARP Forum on Healthcare. Leanne Caldwell has more on this week's political roundup.
Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton revealed more details of her healthcare plan this week. It will allow the uninsured to buy into public health plans. Families and small businesses will receive tax credits, and insurance companies must provide service. She got to tout her ideas at a debate hosted by AARP and broadcast on Iowa Public Television.
When we have quality, affordable health care for every American, you will not see the costs being shifted the way they are now. What happens with Medicare is that everybody squeezes down the payments to doctors, which is not a good idea. We want doctors to be making decisions, not insurance companies.
At the same forum, Democratic hopeful John Edwards promised to protect the elderly from predatory lending.
We actually need a national home rescue fund to help people who've spent their entire lives investing in their home. For the vast majority of them, it is the only real asset that they have, and they shouldn't lose that asset because they're being taken advantage of.
Senator Barack Obama opted out of the debate. Candidates Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel were not invited. As Russell Mokyber with Counterpunch put it, Dennis Kucinich's plan for a one-supplier universal government-run health care would put AARP out of business. Obama also opted out of a Senate vote that condemns MoveOn.org for a newspaper advertisement. He was in D.C., though. He cast a vote just minutes before on a separate measure. Democrat Bill Richardson and all the Republican candidates courted the influential National Rifle Association. Rudy Giuliani had to prove himself to be a Second Amendment defender after pushing for liability lawsuits and gun restrictions as New York City mayor.
What I was doing during the time that I was mayor is taking advantage of every law and every interpretation of every law that I could think of to reduce crime in New York City. And to say that I was excessive in doing that, do not feel singled out. I was excessive in every way that I could think of in order to reduce crime.
Giuliani also said September 11th helped him to change his position. Republican Senator John McCain spoke about a rock to the NRA. He was interrupted by Code Pink activists.
Well, my friends, we beat you yesterday, we beat you the day before, we'll beat you today, and we'll beat you tomorrow. We won't choose to lose.
President Bush says he'll be an asset for Republicans in the 2008 elections. Meanwhile, his agriculture secretary, Mike Johanns, has stepped down, likely to run for the Republican Senator Chuck Hagel's seat, who announced his retirement last week.
In a sense, I brought Nebraskans with me to every cabinet meeting, every hearing on Capitol Hill, every negotiating session in faraway countries.
And finally, two senators have a plan to change how the primary elections work, to streamline the process and give the control to the feds instead of the states. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The killing of Madhesi leader Moin Khan in southern Nepal Sunday has sparked vicious sectarian violence pitting Madhesis against Pahadis. Some 36 people have been killed, several dozens brutally maimed, and thousands have fled the district since then. Madhesis outnumber the Pahadis, but both groups are facing the backlash. And despite curfews imposed in several areas, violence remains unbridled. PC Dubey reports.
Southern Nepal's Kapilvastu district bordering India is the birthplace of Lord Buddha, the apostle of nonviolence. For the past 6 days, the region has witnessed bloodshed following the murder of a local politician. Sectarian violence has erupted, forcing many to flee to neighboring India and internally displacing thousands. Krishna Adhikari is a local Pahari journalist. He says a milieu of terror prevails in the rural areas and the administration has failed to contain the violence.
The situation is still beyond control. Thousands of people of the district have fled to India and neighboring Nepalese districts.
Sushil Pyakurel is a member of a Kathmandu human rights group. While visiting some of the affected areas yesterday, he was shocked to discover that sectarian violence was so ferocious and widespread.
Even now, depending on the place, individuals from one community are continuing to attack the property of members of another community. We believe the negligence of the district administration and the inaction of the security forces is responsible for such bloodshed.
The local district chief, Narendra Dahal, denies any allegations of negligence. He says they have managed to contain the violence despite limited resources. According to Dahal, the surge in violence was unexpected, but now military forces have been deployed in all affected areas.
We smell a whiff of conspiracy in the entire episode. If it was not so, how, just within half an hour of the killing of Khan, could a spate of rioting and marauding engulf various parts of the district?
In response, the Nepalese government created a high-level committee headed by a High Court judge to investigate the extent of the damage and recommend compensation to the victims and legal action for those involved. Water Resources Minister Gyanendra Bahadur Karki says the government has also worked out a relief package for the victims of the violence.
We have decided to provide 10,000 rupees to each of the families of people killed, 10,000 to families whose houses have been burned down, and 5,000 rupees to families that have suffered minor damages. For this, we have released 1 billion rupees.
With elections only 61 days away, the Nepalese government is now faced with a call by Maoists for a two-day strike, a campaign to disrupt the polls and recommitting to the peace process. From Bhairawa in Nepal, I'm PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo, sitting in for Tina Gysi. Today's headlines editor is Mitch Jezerich, sitting in for Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. And our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Antonio Ortiz and Rose Katabchi. I want to let our listeners know that I will be taking a two-month leave, but will be back with you at the end of November. Until then, I'm Ara Bogado from Pacifica Station, KPFK in L.A.